Welcome to the Think It Isn't Until It Is podcast. I'm Finn.
I'm Tim.
I'm Guy.
Chapter 3, that's the B-sides covered, autumn 2006 to summer 2008, in which we write and record Distance and Time, head to the USA, play a crap gig in Belgium, support Massive Attack. Tim has a bit of a wobble. Finn gets overawed by Manu Katché and Pino Palladino. Guy gets detained by customs. Venues begin to sell out, and a teenage Ed Sheeran comes to a show.
Very good.
And all of that happened.
It did.
It's a busy old chapter.
Packed with moments. And it's weird how much these early moments have such a strong sort of memory imprint. I remember some of these moments like as clear as day. Yeah. I really do.
It's weird because it feels, because we've done quite a lot as a band, it feels like it should be longer ago. But actually, I mean, it was 2007 was 14 years ago, which in some areas of life, like 14 years ago seems like the blink of an eye. Like when you think about, like that was the year that Elbow's The Seldom Seen Kid came out, and that to me feels like a recent album,
right?
You know what I mean? but like it obviously in terms of us it was a forever ago, but this period was the period in which we kind of got some key figures on board in the Think story, and we'll come to one particularly important one a bit later, but yeah, some, you know, things like particular agents that we started working with, and friends we made on the promo circuit and so forth, like the aforementioned Manu Katché, who we went on to do a couple of TV shows with.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, the more you travel, the more you meet people, and you know, if you don't like traveling, then being in a band is probably a bad career choice.
Totally.
You know what I mean? If you're a bit of a homebody, if you're a bit of a nest builder, you know.
Absolutely.
And this is the period where, you know, Europe really opened for us. America, we went to America for the first time. And we recorded the tricky second album, which is kind of where this chapter begins, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, like I do in the book, I'd like to say that this, I think it ties for first place of my favorite Think album, this one, because I just think
Distance and Time.
Yeah, for sure. It just, I don't know, it just captures something. Certain period in your songwriting, a certain period in the way we played together with, there's some particularly nice trio moments on this record. And it just, for me, I think it's got that kind of perfect blend of the kind of Think that became what we became afterwards, but also the kind of early Ninja influenced period as well.
I mean, the Biscuits for Breakfast was definitely, as Guy puts it very well in the book, you know, it was definitely kind of, I was driving this train and I needed extra bits. But after all the gigs and all the shared experiences that we had on the Biscuits for Breakfast sort of touring, oh, I want to call it touring, but really it's just like random gigs strung together. By the time we hit Distance and Time, we'd actually played together a lot as a unit. So a lot of the songs were coming together when you would be thinking of drumming as in what would suit Think. I would be writing songs thinking what would suit Think. Guy would be doing bass lines as in what would suit the band. And so therefore Distance and Time actually sounds like a really coherent body of work, like a band who's really a band, you know?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think one of my favorite songs on it is Under the Same Stars, which doesn't get kind of wheeled out very often these
doesn't.
Days. But I do love it. I still, you know, if I listen to that one, I still think, yeah, that was actually, I don't think we could have done that any better. That was, you can tell that we're a band on that one. We're responding to each other's, the rhythmic patterns and so forth.
Yeah, maybe, actually, I think maybe one of the songs off Biscuits and Time, one of the songs off Biscuits for Breakfast, which was a kind of premonition of Distance and Time, was You Gotta Choose, where we're all kind of banding up big time. And then I think So Many Roads, Distance and Time, was one of the first tracks down for the new album. But we were kind of writing it as we were touring. We were so... Well, certainly I was so in love with the kind of I'm writing songs now, I'm playing songs now thing, that songs were getting written while we were touring Biscuits for Breakfast and getting gigged while we were touring Biscuits for Breakfast.
Definitely. And also big difference between this album and some of the others is that we didn't stop gigging. So throughout Distance and Time, we were the recording period, we were jetting off to do, you know, gigs here and there. In fact, I think I remember I mean, this is skipping forward a little bit, but I remember sitting in a diner in Chicago, and which was sort of March, I think, 2007, and saying to you, I'd really like to put some drums on This Is The Thing, because you'd already played me the song. And it was one of those situations where it was kind of sort of done-ish. It could have potentially just ended up on the record like that. And I said, I'd really like to put some drums on it. And then we played it in a couple of gigs, and that's how it sort of ended up being.
I guess the guitar part, the song, the actual songwriting part of This Is The Thing, I wrote it with Blair McKeachan. I went round to his massive epic rock pad in Hastings, and because he's a pianist, you know, he knows a lot of chords, and it was a very chordy like mission, very much out of my comfort zone. And there's so much information in the acoustic track. I just didn't think there's any room for anything else.
Sure.
You know, all the drums are in the guitar track and everything. And I just thought, well, you know, I can't imagine a drum beat on this. But then the percussion that you brought to the table isn't your traditional sort of drum beat anyway. It's not like an indie beat. It's very, very embedded, you know. It's like a real reflection of what the guitar's doing.
Yeah.
I think we did try to put bass on it. I often look back and wonder whether we ever actually even tried, because I couldn't recall for the longest time. And actually, I think we did. I think I did come down and we did do a session on it. And I think we spent the entire day, Finn, just looking at each other with the, nah, none of this is contributing anything. And I think we were a bit sort of annoyed and crestfallen about it at the time. But it's funny how over the subsequent years, you know, you begin to work in different little tricks that do work and are applicable, but maybe only in a live context. And I guess it's that transition that we were able to bring to the recording of Distance and Time. Some of the tracks, like you say, with You Gotta Choose, is a really good example, because the Biscuits recording of it is very faithful, very straight. But we noticed live, especially when we were doing those early support slots, that we were going to need to do something a little bit more if we wanted to grab people's attention. I remember you saying, are there any riffs from you boys' band history? There must be a riff that we could use to sort of build a loop at the end that's going to be more dynamic and do something. And me and Tim, we managed to get something that we used to do working really well. And I think that opened a door to you sort of thinking, okay, right, these boys' previous band collabs might actually be more fruitful, which is...
Well, it's about taking it somewhere, isn't it, sometimes?
Exactly, and make it, yeah. Figuring out where it's useful, where it's applicable, where it's going to work with the dynamics. And yeah, Under the Same Stars is a perfect example. I think Trouble's What You're In is actually, I'd say, is the same sort of thing.
The interesting one as well is Little Blue Mailbox. That was quite an early... I remember hearing that and thinking, Christ, this has taken a bit of a turn
Finn turned up with that one from somewhere else, though, didn't you, bro? Where was that from? Where did you?
Yeah, that's right, man. I did some kind of, you know, PRS or Musicians Union sort of co-write at GSM.
It was like a retreat.
No, it was like a music school. I was really gutted because I went to this music school to do a kind of songwriting writer's retreat type thing, and I realized that all these kids were at school and they all had rehearsal rooms and drum kits. Yeah. And, you know, I was like, damn, I wish I'd done that. I don't have any of this, and I'm a working musician, and you guys have all of this, and you're just at college. But yeah, I wrote the song. The song got written on that camp, and it was a great song. And I kind of said to the girl who wrote it, whose name escapes me now, unfortunately, you know, I wonder if I would be okay if I recorded that. And she very kindly sort of said yes. But my main memory from Little Blue Mailbox was the fact that at the end of it, we were in the Brighton loft and we wanted to talking about taking it somewhere. And we were like, okay, where are we going to go at the end? And me and you kind of built like a Metallica type metal riff at the end out of bits and pieces lying around the studio, like a kind of, like a kind of scrapyard ending version. And then we tried to like really step up to it in the studio, didn't we? Kind of really went for it.
I remember it was the first time I've ever used a massive bass fuzz. And in Andy's studio, I remember that it was a strange sound for Fink. For me, when I heard it playing back, I was thinking, is this really a bit, sounds more appropriate for, you know, Morbid Angel or Cattle Decapitation? But there you go. it definitely worked. But also, I remember I'd really ballsed up something. We were trying to do a track before we recorded Little Blue Mailbox, and I embarrassed myself on the bass. I had a really horrible time, just wasn't working. And then I remember we went to do Little Blue Mailbox next, and I loved that bass. And like you say, it was very metally, so it was right in my wheelhouse. And I remember just furiously blasting it out, really, really angry take. And it was just done, and that was the take that's on the recording. I remember Andy turning around as well and saying, you know, okay, very spiky, but job done. it was great.
Should we talk about how we met Andy Barlow then?
Yeah.
I think it's you, how you met Andy Barlow. And then
at the Comedia, right?
It's a very, very, it's a very different experience. Biscuits for Breakfast was made in the loft, made in Brighton, DIY, you know, soft T-shirts on snares and, you know, how many mics have we got and headphone cables stretched across the length of the room to the most extreme level. And because we couldn't afford to buy extension cables, it really was that simple. But we did a gig at the Comedia in Brighton and Andy Barlow was there. And I don't remember how or why he was there, but I think he must have just heard a track somewhere. Do you guys know how he came to be there?
No. Did it have anything to do with Lou Rhodes? Because we'd already supported her twice.
Probably, yeah.
Then maybe it was then. We'd supported Lou Rhodes at Jazz Cafe and we'd just supported Lou Rhodes at Paradiso the first time we were at Paradiso. You're quite right. So yeah, maybe it got to Andy through Lou, but Andy Barlow was in a band called Lamb, which was it's a big band, but they had the kind of zenith in the kind of 90s. They were a kind of big 90s band, and I saw them live in Bristol, you know, just as a normal person, you know, years ago. And then Andy came to this gig at the Comedian for some unknown reason. He thought we were really good and was like, I'd love to produce, you know, your record, your next record in my house, which we thought was awesome, because I really, Biscuits for Breakfast was exhausting. You know, I loved every minute of it, but producing and recording and engineering and writing and singing and thinking and all that, it's exhausting. And the thought of a producer coming in and producing my record, I thought, oh yeah, this feels good.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the tricky thing was, can we possibly afford this? You know, at that point, we were still on trip-hop advance level money of like 1,500 quid an album, and it was obvious Andy was going to cost a lot more than that. But I think he wanted to do it so much, he cut us an unbelievably sweet deal, and we were recording in his house, so there was no studio overheads.
Yeah.
So to speak. And so I think I can't remember playing demos, but I'm sure we played him a bunch of demos and said, this is what we're thinking of and this is what we're doing. And then we just kind of had a date in the diary and trundled off, didn't we?
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of demos. I remember it was almost the entire album as a demo, which was, at that point, I think there were still question marks about whether that was going to be the album that was going to be released. And then I think what probably happened was Ninja stepped in and said, look, we got Andy on board. I think I remember Summit saying they really like the link, because it's quite a cool link. I remember thinking it was a great, because I saw Lamb as well back in the early 2000s. And just the idea, you know, when you hear certain pairings that you just think make sense, and Fink produced by Andy Barlow just made a lot of sense.
Yeah, it did sound, it sounded like a grown-up had arrived and a father of this sound had arrived. Because I suppose Lamb could arguably be described as a kind of folktronica sort of hybrid, big time, I suppose.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And if you listen to Andy's ears on some things like the, you know, subtler things, maybe like the low end on drums, it's very Lamb sound. It is a very Lamb sound that he produces, and it definitely did work really well for us.
Yeah. Well, he came up with some amazing ideas. Like, I remember things like we were playing that song, If You Stayed Over, which became Make It Good. And he was the one who suggested upping the tempo, because I think we were doing it, you know, considerably slower.
Right.
And I remember sort of thinking, because he was in the control room, we were listening, and he was sort of saying it should be this tempo, and he was playing it tapping it on the control room table or whatever. And I remember thinking, yeah, this is what a real producer does. This is what they do. They don't just sit at the desk and tweak the knobs. They actually say, right, this is the tempo, maybe even change the key kind of thing.
I mean, I'd recorded If You Stayed Over with Bonobo for his record as a guest vocalist. And it was a lot slower because of the sample that he'd picked. But the deal was done so that I could re-record it if I renamed it.
Oh, yeah.
And you're quite right. You know, that track in particular, Andy had to really work as a producer, because it wasn't just like, play it on guitar, Tim does the beats, Guy does the bass, and we're golden. That took a lot of work, you know, and different versions, different tempos. Yeah. But we were getting produced. It was really a wonderful experience. It wasn't, I don't feel like it was at any point frustrating or annoying or difficult. I think it was the first time we'd all been produced.
Yeah.
So we were just kind of like, Andy, you're supposed to be this producer guy, so do what you're supposed to do, because we don't know.
He was really on it as well, wasn't he? He was concentrated.
And super focused, yeah.
I remember also the drum beat at the beginning of the whole album, actually, Trouble's What You're In. So the drums that you hear right at the start, he recorded that by putting loads of mics around the kit and whacking them up. So everything I did, like if I did this with my fingers, it would be deafening. And I played that beat literally just by tapping with my fingers on the snare and the lightest hit on the kick drum.
Yeah.
And it makes this enormous sound. That was such an eye-opener.
Yeah.
I'd never done anything like that at all.
Yeah, he did have some great techniques, man, definitely. And we used the back of the couch for one beat, and we used, like, anything that was lying around. And
he also had such tasty kit that, you remember he had those ancient ribbon mics that were being used as overheads, and they actually managed to pick up a pizza delivery man. You can hear it. It's on one of the tracks. You can hear a pizza guy drive up
the gravel. You can hear the gravel spurting, can't you?
Outside of the wheels spinning in.
It was so cold, you could hear. We had the fire on in the living room where we were doing most of the live recording. You can hear the fire in the background on a few takes, and it's not like a kind of fireside sample. It's just like it was freezing in his house, and you know, we literally had to burn things to stay warm.
I remember, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Finn. I wanted to ask you, how did you come across Get Your Share? Because that was Pet.
Yeah, Get Your Share. Okay, yeah, that was it was a cover, and we were still very much open to covers at the time, weren't we? So we were doing covers to fill space, and I did a remix for this band. And instead of doing a remix, I just did a cover, and I thought it had so much, you know, groove and power that I really wanted it on our own album as a cover. Yeah. They were very good. I'd forgotten all about that. So that's on Distance and Time too.
Yeah,
Get
Your
Share.
I mean, that was one of my favourites, you know.
I'd completely forgotten that was a cover.
Yeah, indeed. It sounds like a Fink song. I mean, it sounds like you would have written it. It's got lines in there that sound like Finn lines.
I'm going to have to go and find the original now. I'm really intrigued. Oh, yeah, used to live on cloud 9, now I moved to 8. I do remember.
It's very different than the original. It sounds like a kind of banging indie banger.
But I guess, funnily enough, this illustrates the kind of not hurry. We weren't being hasty, but this illustrates that we wanted to capitalize quickly on Biscuits for Breakfast. You know, we'd put out our first album. It had been well received. We'd done a support tour. Gigs were flying in. Festies were getting booked. And we were just like, okay, we need to move quickly. How many songs have we got? And it's like, well, I guess we had 6 or 7 originals and 2 covers, you know, Little Blue Mailbox and Get Your Share. Make It Good was a rework from the Bonobo, you know, guest vocal appearance. So it's kind of like we were just in a hurry to get an album ready without freaking me out as a writer and go, okay, great, you've done 7. We need another 5.
Yeah.
And it had probably taken all of my skill set and juice and inspiration to get those 7. And so I probably didn't want the hassle of, all right, dude, that's great. You've just learned how to play a song and sing a song and tour. Now you've got to do another 5 right now before we go in. And I didn't want anything to suck.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't want us to have any weak points, because Ninja had kind of drummed into us this, your albums have to be airtight, because if there's any weak tracks, those are the ones that the journalists are going to zero in on.
Yeah,
you know, there's a lot of willingness to hate this project, you know, so it has to be as airtight as you can make it. And I think that was one of the great things about Andy and recording it at Andy's Rock Palace on the outskirts of Brighton, is the fact that Andy's an airtight producer type guy. He didn't want a single note to not be right.
Yeah.
And when we got to like the 30th version of Make It Good, we were quite aware that, okay, Andy is like a perfectionist. Not in a stupid way, but just like, I really remember this cute thing that he would do when we were going to put down the final take of a track, you know, and he'd like light a big spliff and be like, okay, I always do this when I put down the final take, and he'd light this big spliff, and then halfway through they'd be like, oh no, that hi-hat is just, that's a little bit too loud, let me just gotta do all that again,
quick, put the joint out,
rewind it, fix it, yeah, you know, put it out, make another one, right, okay, this is the final take. So after like the 17th take, it was like, okay, maybe this tradition should end with Fink, you know. It was just getting so stoned. But yeah, it was wonderful. I remember hearing the demos for Distance and Time come out of Andy's studio and just think, okay, this sounds like a band album. Biscuits for Breakfast sounds like a collection of demos made in my loft to me. But Distance sounds like a record. And I'm like, okay, this is it. This is like a real record. And it had some like moment tracks on it, like This Is The Thing. And we needed a needle to move at this point. We'd toured a lot. We were very, very in debt. We were deeply in the hole to the label, deeply in the hole on touring. Mm. And we needed something to give. And, you know, This Is The Thing is the moment that gave us our first sync. And actually, So Long was our first sync on Biscuits for Breakfast, but it was for a chewing gum advert in America, and we got like nothing, but it was something. Yeah. But This Is The Thing was a real thing because we got like this MasterCard ad, which is crazy. So it was all over TV, and it was on like BA when you sat on the plane, and you know, yeah, I just had some great moments of feeling really proud of myself, yeah. And
I remember it being significant, you know, that the fact that it was on that advert, it really did kick things off, that whole campaign. I think it just felt kind of, okay, we're you know, properly up a notch now, because it just felt like we were being, I mean, that was even before the record came out.
Yeah, I mean, I think also back then, 2007, if you had a music on a TV ad, it was like still a thing.
Yeah.
It was still like a record company would say, you know, as heard on TV. And people would be like, oh, that's interesting. And, you know, I think that that had something to do with Zane Lowe playing Blueberry Pancakes, I think, the fact that This Is The Thing had a TV advert.
Well, he mentioned it, didn't he? I remember because that autumn when Zane Lowe and Colin Murray picked up on Blueberry Pancakes. Zane Lowe did that thing of saying something about it's fine to be introduced to a band by an advert as long as you then go on to like listen to the rest of their work and they carry on doing good stuff. That's fine. It's not a massive problem, which is a cool thing to say.
Well, you know, Jose had done the Tony Bravia ad, of course. I mean, there's a few ads that were notably really, really cool for use of the song as opposed to, you know, any accusations of sellout or cheese, but isn't it funny that these days, nowadays, anything goes. You can hear literally any band you adore from throughout the ages flogging anything from Butter to bloody, you know, Bentleys. It's absolutely mental, isn't it? So I struggled to alliterate there for a second, but you get my point. It's now become something totally different. But yeah, I remember getting people suddenly emailing and texting me saying there's a MasterCard and it sounds exactly like Think, and so it was even just as a sound it was noticeable.
I mean, for the sake of like full disclosure, we didn't get paid a life-changing amount for that. We got paid for a completely worldwide TV ad campaign and the British Airways sponsorship. I mean, they got an absolute bargain out of Ninja, but I think at that point we just needed anything. Any contribution was gratefully received at this point. And it was kind of ironic because it was for MasterCard and all of our MasterCards were completely maxed to the max, having bought, you know, a year's worth of touring on our credit cards. So the irony was that the advert was about a couple traveling all over the world on their MasterCard and having a great time. And yeah, don't worry about it. Don't worry about the money. We'll pay it back later. And we were just kind of like, oh my God, we can't even afford to get to Brussels for our next gig. But
I wanted to ask you about If Only, Finn, because that's another another kind of a door opener of a song as well.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote If Only. It was when I was unafraid of the big power ballad at this point. I've subsequently kind of wandered away from it. Although on Resurgam, I suppose I did pop a nice big ballad in. But I was doing a guest vocalist for Nit and Sawney at the Jazz Cafe, a little residency there, and I think it was like five nights, and I was singing Everybody Loves the Sunshine and Biscuits for Breakfast. I did Electric Proms with them as well, so it was kind of part of that guesty moment vibe. And I just read Mingus's autobiography, The Underdog, where he talked about rehearsing in his head when he was washing dishes, and that really struck a chord with me because I thought, I'm too busy to rehearse, and I need to rehearse. So I kind of was starting to rehearse in my head, thinking songs and thinking chords while I was on trains and buses and cars and stuff like that, trying to rehearse mentally. And I kind of wrote this on the train on the way up to the Jazz Cafe gig one night, just thinking, right, okay, this is the melody and these are the chords. That's a C and that's an A and, you know, okay. And I was on the train when I wrote, I'll be right on the train. I was like literally on the train. Yeah, I wrote it in one super swift. Well, I think the 1619 from Brighton to London Victoria's 49 minutes. So it took me 49 minutes to write, basically. I got to soundcheck and then I played it around in on the guitar, and I'm like, there it is.
Yeah,
it was a big ballad.
Fantastic.
It was a really tricky one, that one, because, you know, we would play it live because the fans really liked that one. But it was difficult because it was a ballad, and when you played a ballad, you needed a quiet venue, and when the venue wasn't quiet, that track felt like a bomb moment.
Yeah.
So it was just really tricky, wasn't it? If only.
Yeah, and I think we experimented with putting me and Guy on it as well. Never quite went anywhere, didn't it?
Yeah, we tried numerous configurations of us doing different things. So it also had to become a you know, Tim and Guy leave the stage. So it's a solo acoustic moment, which is fine when you've got an audience who really want to listen. But as you say, man, in the early days, especially if they weren't, that's just a bit brutal on you, isn't it? Me and Tim just up and bugger off and go and wander off for a nice chilled out beer backstage while you have to play a quiet, delicate ballad to a room full of people who are all going, where's the drummer and bass player gone? That's a bit much.
That sounds like the thought process of a bass player. Obviously, everyone in the audience is wondering where the bass is gone.
Well, but, absolutely, of course.
There are some gigs where If Only sounded amazing. Maroquinerie in Paris, Epicerie Moderne in Lyon.
Yeah, yeah,
these
yeah.
kind of silent, beautifully sounding venues where that track really worked.
But it went down particularly well in France, that song, though, didn't it? Am I right in saying that was what kind of sealed the deal in?
Yeah, I think
France,
so. I mean,
for Distance and Time.
Looking back on Distance and Time, it was actually packed full of fibre, that record. Lots of great tracks like Blueberry Pancakes, This Is the Thing, If Only, Make It Good. You know, there are loads of moments to cling to for fans. So even though, as we say in the book, Distance and Time, after we put it out, we felt it didn't make the kind of seismic, life-defining explosion that we wanted it to, it actually set us up for the next 10 years.
Definitely.
We got a lot of fans in a lot of places because of that record. And we worked it, we toured it hard. You know, we played everywhere on Distance and Time because we were still... we hadn't quite hit the splitter years. We hadn't quite hit chapter four. We were still at the public transport years.
Yeah.
So our kit, we should explain, our kit was still, we can get the train to the gig level of kit.
Yeah.
So Tim's drum kit was a couple of cases and his brassware. I was one guitar and a hand luggage, and Guy was one guitar and hand luggage. And we could just get the Eurostar to Brussels or to Amsterdam, or to Paris.
Yeah, and did. Awesome. Yeah, exactly. It was really, really fun. I remember getting on the train to go to the Maroquinerie with all my gear. So I had my, you know, kick drum, busy Eurostar in the morning, and Guy was there as well. And I was trying to get it into the luggage rack, you know, essentially this full drum kit that I was bringing on. and there was a woman, a very cross lady, who was looking at me, trying to sort of shovel the other suitcases out of the way to make room. And she said, I don't know what the hell you're doing bringing a drum kit on the train. I felt like saying, God, you know, you should see the rest of my week.
I got it. So funny you mentioned that. I haven't actually thought about the size of the luggage compartments of the Eurostar for a long time. But when we would hit the Eurostar, one of the numerous times we Eurostarred over to Europe in this period, Guy's bass, my guitars, and your drum kit would essentially be the luggage compartment of the Eurostar.
Right.
And man, the people would hate us.
I know. I always sided with them. When that woman started on Tim, I think the saddest thing for Tim was that I sided with her completely. Just, I don't know what you're doing bringing drums on the train. I was like, it's nuts. What's wrong with this bloke?
I mean, we couldn't have traveled any lighter.
No.
I think that was actually one of the things that allowed us to build and do the Fink thing on Distance and Time. It was how nimble and how light on the feet we were. We could do a gig for €200 in Paris and not lose €2,000 doing it. And we could see around us that the other bands who were like us at that moment in their career, there was a lot of envy. They had buses, maybe they had crew, they had sound guys, they had, you know, monitor, you know, they had the full spec, and we didn't. But it meant that we could go and do Maroquinerie on a €500 fee and cover our backs on it, you know, and which meant that we could play everywhere.
Sure.
And we did. You know, I remember our MySpace was just constant gigs. And even to the point where a few other bands sort of said to me, you know, how are you doing this? You know, how are you doing so many gigs? And it's kind of like, Fink could come and do a gig in your living room. We could literally arrive in a Renault Clio and do this gig, you know? It's like we just wanted to play, didn't
yeah,
we, basically?
Yeah, sure. And we did some crazy stuff. We did the Cognac Blues Festival, which involved us playing for 4 days, essentially. And
not in a row, I might add. It wasn't like a non-stop. Guinness World Record attempt. It wasn't the longest gig in history, although it did at times feel like that.
But yeah, it was cool because that was like a kind of, we learned to play the songs on distance. Like I feel like we did a lot of touring for distance before it even came out.
Yeah, I feel that way too. I know what you mean. I mean,
I forget that was that way around. It's only when we were writing this book that I was reminded of this. In my head, it was already out.
I think that we were still picking up gigs from Biscuits for Breakfast when we had already recorded Distance and Time.
That's yeah. right. That'd be right.
So it was the following summer from Biscuits for Breakfast. It was almost like festival season round two on the first album, but we'd already recorded the second album. And it's interesting because I saw Mumford do. We all saw Mumford do the same thing. You know, they released their first album. By the time their second album had come out, we'd already seen that show.
Yeah.
We'd already seen the second album played live because they'd already written it, recorded it, and played
it.
So, I mean, we did. One of the great things about this was the fact that, yeah, we did play the album a ton of times before the album came out, and then we toured it after the album came out, and we were actually already good at playing it.
Yeah.
I say good, I mean, you know, we could play it. But Cognac Blues was great because we had to play three different types of stages in 4 days to essentially the same audience. So you couldn't literally trot it out. We had to do a little gig in a field, we had to do a main stage, and we had to do, what was the other one?
A meat factory.
A sweaty gig in an abattoir.
Which was the good one. That was the last one, right? I enjoyed that one the most.
That was really good. It was really vibey. I felt like we were a kind of a band for a club.
Yeah.
Like when I did the kick drum to things like Biscuits, obviously, you know, people actually danced. It was actually a kind of, okay, this is a kind of hot sweaty club with people kind of listening to the music. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a lot of variation.
I mean, we also did a lot of things that, you know, weren't fun. We did one of our least favorite gigs in band history at Resseclart in Brussels in this period, which was like the worst gig ever, I think, for me you and Guy. I mean, it was just awful.
Well, I think that gig was very much a big signpost to us saying, you should now be in a splitter. You know, you shouldn't be doing this kind of thing anymore on hired gear with no sound engineer of your own. You know, you now should be on a different level.
Yeah.
So I felt that was busting out of our old shackles. But it was such a learning curve, you know, because now we know that, yeah, you do. Even now, every band gets the odd kind of crap gig amid the good ones, and
of course
the fact that they can deal with it is probably one of the reasons why they're still at it, you know.
I mean I think you say that in the chapter of the book, in fact, don't you actually say, you know, it's how you deal with, you know, you're regularly grounded as a band because for every great show, like whether it's a 300 sellout or a 150 sellout or a 5,000 sellout, for every sellout show where you go, oh my God, I'm a rock legend and this will be hewn into the living rock of rock. And then the next gig you do is going to be one of those grounding, you know, no, you're not. You're just some English band shoved on a bill on a Wednesday in Brussels, and it's going to suck. And the audience actually thought you weren't very good. And then you go, right, okay. The mission then becomes, how do we make every show that good one and avoid the bad ones? And the answer is you can't possibly avoid the bad ones. Even at big band level, you're going to have shows. Like on every tour, you're going to have the best and the worst gig of the tour.
Yeah,
as simple
definitely.
As that. And you don't know what that's going to be until the last show of the tour, because that could be the best or the worst gig. So it's kind of, it's how you manage expectations and your own ego and
your enjoyment as well. Because I remember, I know this is, again, skipping far forward, but we always talk about that gig in Thessaloniki on a Tuesday in February. And there were literally 40 people in the audience. And this was on the Hard Believer tour. So we were, you know, used to considerably more than that. But I still remember enjoying it. You know,
Me too, because it was like memory lane, wasn't it? It was like, I remember when there was only 40 people at the show because it was raining. Okay, great. We know how to do this. Let's do it, you know? Yeah. Also, you know, we are a very conscientious band, and we were already very conscientious at this stage. We were very much kind of like, there's 60 people that have paid or blagged a guest list for this show. So, you know, we're going to give those 60 people a show like we think we're playing, you know, Wembley Stadium, and it's and we're at the height of our powers. We're just going to do everything we can to make this awesome. Yeah. Because, you know, we were just grateful there were 60 people there. Just like when we played Vera in Rotterdam. In Groningen, sorry. And, you know, there were 90 people there.
Yeah.
But the promoter said, that's really good, because when, you know, U2 played here, there were 60 people. And you kind of go, oh, wow, we're doing better than U2. Oh, the future's going to be great then, isn't it?
That was on this tour as well. That was on Distance and Time. But that was not with me. That was with Canadrian. So I suppose we should address the Canadrian situation.
The little elephant in the room here. The first time Timmy quit the band.
Well, you say the first time. I think this might have been, the big one was the second time. So I had a little wobble at the end of the Biscuits era, and said I wasn't able to do any more for a while.
That's true.
And then I got you know, I kept getting asked, well, can you just do this one gig? Can you just do this one recording session? And every time I did
just it... one more job.
Every time I did it, it was just more and more fun. And I remember thinking, God, I can't quit this. This is ridiculous.
I think it also... I remember this, Timmy, you know. I remember me and Guy being absolutely cool with all the decisions you were making. We totally understood it. But it was making that leap into the freelance unknown... total, you know, stupidity of, well, I'm just gonna do it then. You know, and get rid of the safety net. And the problem is, the safety net is very useful. If you do fall off the scaffolding,
yeah,
you're really glad it's there.
Sure.
And we weren't at the stage where you could go, oh, I'm gonna be in this band now, it's paying all the bills and my rent's gonna be paid and my wife's gonna be happy. And we were no way near that at this point.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the maybe you could, you know, maybe it was just like, you know, I can't commit. I'd love to, love it, love you guys, love the band, but I just can't see myself committing to this.
Yeah.
To this.
Yes.
To this, getting the Eurostar at 7 a.m. on a day that I've blagged from work by phoning in sick to do a gig for 100 people, to enjoy it, to get some free beers, to go home again, and then the next day be back at my desk.
Yeah.
Exhausted. Yeah. A little bit more broke.
I just felt like I was being stretched by a stretching machine. You know, I just was spread so thin. And it just became a case of, well, look, I'm not doing either thing well here. I'm not doing Fink as well as I could be doing. And I'm not doing family life as well as I could be doing. And I'm not doing my day job as well as I could be doing. So something's got to give. So, I did, as Guy put it in the book, equivocably, what's it? I can never say that word. What the fuck is it?
Unequivocally
quit.
Nearly.
You did, but you know, we knew we were gonna now we're having this conversation. I remember something now, which was, I remember you saying, I'm quitting playing live.
Did I?
But if you need me to play on any recordings, you know, it'd be a
yes,
pleasure.
You're right.
But you know, I can't do the gigs anymore.
That's right. You're absolutely
so,
right.
That's like saying, you know, I'll help you build the house by kind of painting the windowsills.
Mm.
You know, but you build the house and I'll paint. And it was the good bit. It was the recording bit. Mm. And it was the bit that was the most manageable to fit in.
Yeah.
So I think me and Guy were both like, we were okay with that deal. We were like, yeah, we need Timmy on the recordings because that's kind of what Fink kind of sounds like.
Mm.
And I can't imagine it without Tim on the records. So, you know, and other bands seem to have these problems. You know, you have different... the Beatles replaced Ringo Starr for a tour, you know,
yeah.
As we all know, which ended by Ringo Starr coming back, which leads us to the next moment, which is you coming back.
Yeah. I mean, I can't remember actually coming back, but then when I did come back, it was forever.
Well, I did the gigography for the book recently, and I can see from the gigs that, you know, you kind of quit, and then we toured with Canadrian, a great friend of ours who's an awesome drummer, and he stepped in, did a bunch of festivals, Holden Pop, and all some really great shows with Adrian, a tour of Holland and stuff like that. And then you came back for a few.
Yes.
And then you were gone again, and there's another tour with Adrian.
Yeah.
And then me and Guy did a bunch duo vibes, and then you came back. So I think you were kind of always kind of I remember you left the door open as an if you're really in a bind,
yeah,
call me.
Yeah. But then it just became, and then, you know, it just became obvious, I think. Well, one of the things that I have to mention at this point, because in 2008, which is the period we're talking about, I got my book deal.
Here we go. I knew the book advertising was going to start at this point.
No side projects.
The reason I say that is because, ironically enough, because I got an advance and I had to do a second book, that was what finally got me to quit the day job.
Nice.
So funnily enough, it was the writing that kind of sealed the deal.
Nice.
And then, you know, from then on, I actually did give up the day job and was able to do whatever you threw at me.
That's a beautiful thing. The book is available now at all good booksellers, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, it is. The first one was The Alternative Hero. So that was what got me it. And that's available. And then Death of an Unsigned Band was the one I had to write. But that's skipping forward to revolution time.
Oh, there'll be another plug for the books in the podcast.
There will be, yeah. But you guys should talk a bit about, you did some stuff like South Africa, you did Massive Attack, you did all sorts of things like that.
When we went out with some of the runs with Canadian, we did do some ridiculously brilliant festivals. In amongst that Holden Pop year, there was the Massive Attack gig, which... God, what more do you want to say? I mean, you're supporting Massive Attack in a Roman amphitheater in a hot autumnal, you know, hot summer's night in the south of France. I mean, it was literally just
the best ever. I remember that show real well because for lots of reasons. I mean, one of them was that Massive Attack's mixing desk broke down before they went on. Their mixing desk, the actual console that ran the whole gig.
Yeah.
And before our show... our mixing desk got wiped as well by accident, by someone. It was an accident. I don't know. But anyway, it was one of those, oh no, the mixing desk got erased. And then when it happened to Massive Attack, they had a spare one.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, they travel with a spare mixing desk. I mean, dude, that's just next level business. And they weren't around for our set. And we did our set and we did, you know, you got it. I don't know what we were playing, but the last three songs of our set were absolute crackers. It was like, and we finished with Sorry I'm Late with a big kind of like, you know, big ending. And I remember that they did see the last sort of 7.5 minutes of the show, at which point the audience were loving it. We were having a great show. It started badly, but it ended well. But they only saw the ended well
Brilliant.
Bit. So after the show, they were kind of like, "Man, who are you guys? Wow!" And
that's cool.
Yeah, it was really epic. I mean, I remember when Horace Andy came on. I'm a huge Horace Andy fan, and when he came on stage to sing Angels, it was just kind of like, "Holy shit!" Me and Guy were just like losing it. We were loving it.
Yeah.
It was just awesome, and we were getting paid.
Yeah.
Which was just like. It was
one of the most amazing shows I've ever seen, still to this day, top three gigs of my life. So to have been on the bill for it, just, yeah, amazing, man. Absolutely.
That was really nice. We also did South by Southwest at this point, which is an absolute meat market. Any band that's just played it will know.
Oh, God.
And we flew in, with Summit, with management, who was great. I'm so glad he was there. He made it good. Otherwise, it was just going to be a sales conference. It was really brutal. But, flying into South By and doing South By was an eye opener because of all the bands and everybody there and, you know, just the hassle and the horror and how shit everything is, but how much fun it all is as well to be in America.
Totally,
which is great. I think we did Joe's in New York for the first time, Chicago for the first time.
Joe's Pub and the Empty Bottle in Chicago.
I'm not sure what prompted us getting those gigs because we didn't really get America until the next album, but. I'm really not sure how we sold any tickets to those gigs, but we did. I don't know how.
I think actually you can trace like the Joe's Pub gig, etc. Mate, not being funny. I think that Wrigley's advert that So Long went out on actually did do a little bit for us in America. It did move the needle a little bit. There was a little bit of love over there. Do you remember there was a lot? It was very popular with a certain demographic that advert. It appealed largely to a lesbian audience. And do you remember there was
what?
It did because
did it?
Yeah, do you not remember, mate? Because it was all about
the waitress. The advert was like the waitress about girls
is really, yes. The waitress is really hot. She offers a bit of she goes to take a bit of chewing gum off the other lady, and they have a real like ooh moment, and yeah, we get a lot of love from that part of the world. So yeah, I think that was what helped in America. I really do think so.
Interesting. I mean, I do remember Joe's Pub. You mentioned it in the book because John Legend came to that show, and I was doing some. I was being teed up to write with him for his next album. And he came to the show to check us out, and that was quite intimidating. Luckily, just like Pino Palladino and Manu Katché, I actually didn't really know who he was at this point, yeah. Which was really good, because if I'd have known,
yeah,
the only
right.
moment I knew who John Legend was really was when we left the studio in New York after having done a bit of writing, and I said, let's get a coffee. And he was a bit like, let's get a coffee in. And I'm like, oh, come on, let's go for a walk. So we went for a walk, and he couldn't walk down the street.
Right.
It was literally like cars going past, going, beep, beep, hey, John, yeah, love your records, man.
Really? You know,
it was totally constant. It was literally like he couldn't walk down the street.
Shit.
And I'm like, holy shit, man, this guy's famous as hell. Yeah. I had no idea. And, you know... And but he was at Joe's Pub on that big, beautiful round table, because Joe's Pub is really tiny. I think it holds like 100 people. Mm. And I think Amy Winehouse had played a few nights earlier. And I was a bit bummed out that we'd missed each other. And then John was at this big table like at Joe's Pub. And it was all kind of like, wow, New York.
Yeah.
Did we stay at the Andy Warhol Hotel, Guy? Was that the time we stayed there and we had like 45 minutes sleep?
Yeah, that is.
What was it, the Gershwin?
Yeah, it was the Gershwin. But you know how grumpy Guy is at the best of times
of
when it comes to checking into a trendy hotel. And the theme of this hotel is the rooms were kind of like hospital beds.
Yes, that's right. They were.
And obviously Guy's grumpometer at this point went into maximum overdrive, and we only had an hour before we had to get up and go back to the airport.
That's
so it was just
man,
maximum grump. I mean, it was brutal grump. It was one of the biggest grump fests we ever had. We shouldn't have tried to go to sleep really.
We shouldn't have tried. I mean, sleeping for 40 minutes is a terrible idea. That was a night that confirmed.
I mean, it was more of a nap really. I mean, we didn't undress. We just lied on the bed and
yeah, it's terrible really.
I think even in Guy's sleep he was harumphing and grunting pretty hard. even asleep. So we did South by Southwest. We stole the Rapture's rider. Sorry about that, the Rapture. We did Bitterzoot in Amsterdam. That was massive. Now, that was like a fundamental moment for us, for me as a band. And it was a amazing gig. It was the most sold out I think we'd ever had a gig at that point.
I think that was the gig when, while we were sound checking, the promoter came and said something along the lines of, we've had as many applications for tickets after the fact, you could have actually sold out Paradiso or something, or maybe Melkweg. Maybe it wasn't Paradiso, but it was.
Yeah, no,
was...
I think he said you could have done two nights here or something, or three nights here. And we thought, wow, three nights of Bitterzoot. That's like,
yeah.
I mean, it was insane. It was so packed. It was crazy. And the backstage was at the opposite end of the venue. So you had to walk through the crowd to get to the stage. That's a horrible walk at the beginning of the show.
Yeah.
Because you haven't actually set yourself up yet, as the them and us equation hasn't happened yet, so you're just kind of sheepishly saying excuse me can I just get through, and to get through to the stage to do your gig.
Yeah,
but then after the show, you know, we had to get back to the backstage, and man, we were like gods after that show. It was so amazing. I still remember that feeling. I really do.
Yeah.
Hitting that.
It was amazing.
Thinking,
it was.
Damn.
And Rotown was good. That was the day before, I remember, and that was another good one.
Rotown is great because on the wall of Rotown they had all the posters for all the shows that month. Do you remember?
Yeah.
So every band had like an A4 poster, and then they just stuck them up, and there was, you know, 28. There's a band a night basically. So it's like 20, 25 posters. And it was pretty much everybody you wanted to see at the time. You know, all the young bands coming through would be playing Rotown, and it felt great to be one of those 20 posters.
Sure,
to think, we're like those guys.
And that's a classic venue as well, because I think the first time we ever walked in there, it's essentially, if you walk in, it's just like a cafe restaurant. And we just thought, what are we doing here? This is just a cafe restaurant. And what we didn't realize is that they bring out the stage from a sort of hidden cupboard, and essentially they just turn it into an amazing, you know, proper little club venue. So you completely forget that it once was a restaurant.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost like a completely modular venue.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
So bizarre. When you walk in, you're like, and then it just kind of transforms like a transformer into a venue. It's great.
And what I didn't realize until much later is that Night and Day in Manchester, when I first walked into Night and Day, I remember thinking, oh, this is a little bit like Rowtown. Didn't realize they actually based it on Rowtown.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that. Because it was uncanny how similar the vibe was in Night and Day, wasn't it, with the stage and everything.
So these lovely venues that we're discovering on this era, I mean, that was one of the best things about this era, just discovering how many cool venues there are out there.
Yeah, because for every at this stage, at your 200 cap, 300 cap, venue stage, you know, these venues are in it for love. They're not in it for Live Nation or, you know, a beer sponsorship. This is a collective, or one, like in Vera's case, one guy, or in Night and Day's case, a couple, you know, who just want to have a venue to let bands play. And we played all of those, and they are really, they're like all family affairs, aren't they, basically? They're really lovely.
Yeah, exactly.
I miss that. But we also met our long-suffering sound guy, Robalicious, in
this
period.
Indeed, yes. That's very, very, very important, actually. Very crucial.
It is. I thought it was worth mentioning before we wrap up this chapter, because he changed our sound game like no doubt. And you know, the old adage of live music is that you should add dancers before you add musicians to your stage show.
Really? I've never heard that one.
Because people want something to look at.
Yeah, yeah.
So before you add a horn section, you should add dancers. You know, it's like an old Broadway expression. And like, adding Rob as our first member of crew.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way, you know, he
permanent
was our first
member of crew.
Yeah, and he was amazing. I met him at Electric Proms, and I played that, and he was the sound guy I brought in at the last minute because the sound guy cancelled, I think, and Rob was brought in, and he was so amazing. So after we were with Rob, we just felt that okay, our sound out front, that gamble was gone. That weird feeling of I hope it sounded good, because we have no idea.
Was
gone, because lots of people told us, oh man, it sounded amazing. So we thought, okay, Rob, you know,
well, he's
Rob
an
Alicious.
Artist,
he's
you know,
really
he's
good.
A proper he's an artist. He treats it like a kind of sound sculpture from the moment he walks into the venue. And you know, he's obviously, he became so close to us that he was like almost like another member of the band, in that we have to put up with each other's little quirks and foibles.
Absolutely.
And same with Rob,
absolutely.
You know, and Lord knows he has many, but he's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, he also, many times he treated these, like the local crews would say to him, you know, how did you do that?
Yes.
And then he would be like, well, did you see earlier on when I was like moving your entire speaker stack by climbing all over the balcony? I did it like that. And it was like almost like, I remember in a few venues he was given a questionnaire from the tech crew to fill in.
Oh, really? Well, how did you?
They'd written a thing like, how did you make that sound? How did you get that sound? How did you get that speaker to do that? And things like this. You know, he was like a traveling lecturer in front of house sound.
The number of crews I saw him irritate the hell out of by him explaining their configuration was all wrong and they would need to change it all, and they would huff and puff and be really pissed off. And then after the show, they'd come up and say, we have never heard the venue sound like that. And Rob would go, well, yes, of course, I told you. You just need to change the angle of... And that's that.
Mm.
I mean, I swear that must be at least 20 times I've seen that happen. Yeah. Amazing.
Legend.
Robalicious, bless him. And so he's with us for the next... He's with us for the whole of this
absolutely.
Period. Absolute genius. All right, well, that was chapter 3. That's the B-sides covered. Why did we call it that? Why did we call this
because
chapter that's the B-sides covered?
That was Skev, or maybe not Skev himself, but the spirit of Skev definitely heavily channeled through the A&R. The A&R process is what that was, mate. You played loads of demos to the Ninja guys, expecting them to go, oh my God, dude, the Grammy is in the post. And
Side of the Moon 2.0. Yeah.
But the actual response was, that's the B-sides covered.
God, how rude.
Yeah, that's right. No, well, you know, Ninja... They haven't got time to
sugar.
They're not a corporate record company. Yeah. They are like, dude, come on, you know, that's I think they were maybe being funny.
It is quite a funny
trying
thing
to encourage
say.
You, trying to encourage you in a comedic way.
Exactly. Skev had a lot to deal with. Skev, who was A&Ring us from an Ninja Tune at that point, he had a lot to deal with, you know, from us.
I remember meeting him for a coffee one morning, and we were discussing possible things to do. I think this was for Distance and Time, so kind of appropriate to where we're just wrapping up, and he had written down a list of musicians that he thought you should try working with, and I was there for this, and I saw the name Les Claypool on the list.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
One of the greatest bass players for me.
He had an angle. He had a hookup with him. Yeah. I don't know how he had an angle. Yeah,
I know, but as a bass player myself, I remember when I saw that name on the list, I wanted to just reach across the table and silence Skev forever. Frankly, yeah, brilliant. Introduce Finn to Les. I'll just shuffle back to my day job. That'll be fine. No, I didn't want that to happen.
That's right. They were talking guesties all the time, but we swerved that, and I'm glad we did. I'm glad we did, because you know, record companies, they just want you to succeed. They're on your side. You know, they're on your team. They want to score goals too. And so when they say, we think you should have a guest vocalist, or you think you should do a duet, and they say things that just grind your gears, you know, they're only trying to, you know, make your dreams come true. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's, you know, you just have to roll with it like that and politely decline if it's not what you're into.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were no guests on Distance, were there? There was no one else, I don't think.
No, I think it was guest free.
Yeah, yeah.
Possibly because Andy, the entire budget went to Andy.
Sure.
Possibly. I mean, I'm not saying Andy was a, you know, it wasn't much. It basically covered Andy's, you know, meditation costs.
Oh, I guess there were strings on Troubles What You're In, right?
So did we get Matt? Was it Matt Kelly or something? Did we?
Matt Kelly. Yeah.
Yeah, or someone.
He of Perfect Darkness fame. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, there you go. That's the B-sides cover, chapter 3 of our podcast from, what did we cover? Autumn 2006 to summer 2008.
Yeah. So the next phase
from Boys to Men,
chapter 4, is going to be, I think this is quite an exciting one, the next one for me. The Splitter Years.
We don't. No one really has to tune anything anymore to me.
Subscribe, like, click, and subscribe.
Click
and
click in.
That's it.
click us next week.